I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today we're following up on the news that former Vice President Al Gore has been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Here's the announcement from Oslo, Norway.
The Nobel Peace Prize for 2007 is to be shared in two equal parts between the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, and Albert Arnold Al Gore Jr., for their efforts to build up and disseminate greater knowledge about man-made climate change.
The Nobel Committee said that Al Gore is probably the single individual who has done the most to create awareness of global climate change and of the measures that need to be adopted to fight it. Gore shares the award with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the United Nations scientific body that has studied the causes of global warming. With us to talk about this latest chapter in Al Gore's life is Bill Turk, a reporter for the Washington Post and the author of the biography Inventing Al Gore. And welcome, Bill Turk.
Hi, Anthony.
What's your reaction to this award? Surprised? Expected it?
I'm not terribly surprised. I think that it was sort of in the air, so to speak, that it was going to happen. And I think it is sort of a vindication of sorts for him.
Yeah, and talk about that. I mean, in a sense, this probably wouldn't have happened if those events of 2000 had never transpired, right?
I think that's right. History is funny in the way it unfolds, and I think it would have been very difficult for him to do the kinds of things he's done for climate change as an issue if he had been president. There would not have been an inconvenient truth. There would not have been a lot of the advocacy that he's been able to do, and So to that extent, he's been able to do far more for the issue that he cares about than he would have been in office.
And this brings up an issue that strikes me, and I think a bunch of people who have covered Al Gore in the past as a politician, and it's a point that comes through loud and clear in your biography, and it's this, that he comes from this political family, but it never came easy to him. Politics never came easy to him. So in a sense, maybe this is a more fitting and logical accomplishment for him than to be president? What do you think?
I do. I think that in reading some of his comments over the last year in interviews, I think he has come to understand that he was not an especially adept politician and not a particularly good candidate, and that this is probably closer to what he was meant to do. He was meant for a life of scholarship and advocacy and not being a retail politician.
Lots of speculation today, nevertheless, that this award should compel him or could compel him to enter the race for president. I would take him at his word that he's not going to do that. What about you?
I do take him at his word that he's not going to do that. I think there's a number of reasons. One is when you look at the Democratic field, you have two pretty strong candidates who have sucked up a lot of the money and a lot of the support, and it's getting pretty late. But the other thing I think is I think he would risk undoing a lot of the stature that he has built up for himself since the 2000 election. And I think even if you've won a Nobel Prize, if you become a candidate for office, you do become another politician out there grubbing for votes. And I just don't see that happening.
But does it make it more likely that he might consider running the next time? I mean, do you think he still wants to be president, even if it seems that he doesn't like running for it?
I suppose that once you've run and you come that close, I suppose you never really completely give up the idea of being president. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen? I suppose it's possible down the road. But it becomes more unlikely as time goes on and other stars emerge politically. I think that his moment has probably passed for that.
Let me ask you about a statement that Gore released today. He said, "We face a true planetary emergency. The climate crisis is not a political issue. It's a moral and spiritual challenge to all of humanity." And he went on to say, "This is an opportunity to lift global consciousness to our higher level." I'm interested to talk to you as a Gore biographer. I mean, here's a policy guy, some have even said a policy wonk, talking about planetary emergencies and spiritual challenges and consciousness at a higher level. I mean, how do you understand what all that says about Al Gore?
Well, actually, it sounds familiar to me in a way, because I think if you look at the first book he wrote, Earth and the Balance, it also struck some of those themes. It was not a strictly policy, sort of wonkish kind of book. It did have, it was very introspective about his own emotional makeup and also about, you know, there was some spiritualism in it, and I think that's always been a part of him. So to that extent, I think this is kind of a natural outgrowth of themes that he's been sounding since the beginning of his public life.
Hmm. So do you do a sort of second take on the Gore biography to add this chapter?
Special updated Nobel edition? I don't. That's not in the cards for me right now, but it's certainly interesting, you know, watching what's happening to him, yes.
All right, Bill Turk. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Bill Turk. He's a reporter for The Washington Post and author of the biography Inventing Al Gore.
If you look at the 10 hottest years ever measured, they've all occurred in the last 14 years. And the hottest of all was 2005.
And, of course, that's Al Gore from his Academy Award-winning documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, which focused on the challenge of global climate change. A White House spokesman says President George W. Bush is happy about the Nobel Peace Prize awarded today, but he says the president has no plans to call his former political rival to congratulate him personally. Well, for more on the Nobel Peace Prize, Al Gore, and its impact, we turn to Michael McElroy, professor of environmental studies at Harvard University. And Professor McElroy, welcome.
Thank you.
You've known Al Gore for 25 years. He's spoken to your class at Harvard. What's your reaction to this news?
I think it's a wonderful and very well-deserved honor. I think that he has devoted his life to environmental issues and has, I think, reaped the just rewards for his labor.
Of course, it's a big award for Al Gore and for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which shares the award. Do you agree with the head of the IPCC that this is a vindication of science over skeptics?
Yes, I do. I think that this has been a long process in which, in fact, the IPCC has also done a wonderful job of bringing the science to the fore. In a completely objective way, admitting uncertainties where there were uncertainties, and in fact, working to remove them.
And what does this mean for the movement to respond to climate change specifically? I mean, what impact does this have?
I think that on a worldwide basis, it seems to me that there's been very little skepticism about the significance of the challenge of dealing with climate change. But that's been the case for several years. Where the skepticism has really existed has been mostly in the United States, and I think that this is an opportunity for Al Gore's particular leadership to be vindicated. So I would hope, I would expect, in fact, that this is going to make a difference to the reaction and the urgency of dealing with this problem in the United States.
And how specifically will that difference be manifested? In other words, are we going to see things like, you know, getting caps on greenhouse gas emissions?
The real focus, it seems to me, for the United States has to be on taking a long-term view of what our energy future should be. It's pretty clear already that we have problems with our energy mix. I mean, the dependence on foreign oil is an obvious issue. But taking a long-term view of where we have to go is the critical, urgent need. And that has to be done with complete honesty and not just one-liners, which I think has been too much of the political debate in recent years.
And what about globally? Does this give the Kyoto process, the Kyoto Protocol, new momentum, which I guess Kyoto expires in 2012? Does this give that whole process new momentum?
Well, I think that that process is going to continue, but I think that what we now need to do is to focus on what is the appropriate strategy for the long term. In fact, Kyoto was, in some sense, just an intermediate step and wasn't really going to accomplish a great deal other than drawing attention to the need for a long-term plan. So I think that where Vice President Gore now stands is the opportunity to exert some leadership internationally as well as nationally on exactly where we should be going with this.
In a statement today, Vice President Gore said the climate crisis is not a political issue. It's a moral and spiritual challenge to all of humanity. You've been saying the same thing for years, but do you think there is a political aspect to winning this prize? And I'm just sort of wondering, you know, how it's going to play out, for instance, within the current presidential campaign. In other words, I think Vice President Gore will always be associated with a sort of democratic cause. So I'm wondering if this prize is going to come with a certain amount of political baggage, or how do you weigh that?
I don't think that it should. I mean, Vice President Gore obviously is a Democrat, but I think he has always taken a much larger view of his responsibility as a politician. I mean, I've been impressed over the period that I've known him with the way in which he has interacted with foreign leaders, for example, from a very early age. I mean, he was making a significant initiative to try to make sure he understood their point of view and to engage in dialogue.
Hmm. Finally, I have to ask you this question, and it's sort of been, I think people have been talking too much about it. You know, the consensus seems to be that Gore is not going to run for president this year. But do you think Al Gore still wants to be president, and then perhaps he could make a run for the White House in the future? And if so, this award might help him do that.
I would hope very much that he would rethink his position on that. I mean, he's been pretty straightforward about not intending to run. But I would hope that he would see that in some sense it's his responsibility to reconsider that. I mean, he, in my opinion, he is the person who could, in fact, improve the image of the United States that has been very sadly degraded over the last number of years. He is the one person who will be perceived as having a vision that he can communicate not only nationally but also internationally.
Well, as we mentioned, you've known him for some 25 years. You've been mentioned as a possible cabinet member in a possible Gore administration. Are you in touch with him? Have you expressed those views directly to him?
When I've had the opportunity to spend some time with him, I've made it pretty clear that I would hope that he would reconsider.
But no indication that he would.
I think he was tired, jaded after his experience last time. But also, he's been incredibly busy on his new world. His movie, his lectures, his activities. I mean, he's been excited about his new world.
Well, Michael McElroy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Michael McElroy is professor of environmental studies at Harvard University. And we're going to end this segment with a change of mood, but on the same subject. Here's Al Gore on Saturday Night Live last year, appearing as President Al Gore.
And when you overwhelmingly made the decision to elect me as your 43rd president, I knew the road ahead would be difficult. We have accomplished so much, yet challenges lie ahead. In the last 6 years, we have been able to stop global warming. No one could have predicted the negative results of this. Glaciers that once were melting are now on the attack. As you know, these renegade glaciers have already captured parts of Upper Michigan and Northern Maine, but I assure you, we will not let the glaciers win. Right now, in the second week of May 2006, we are facing perhaps the worst gas crisis in history. We have way too much gasoline. Gas is down to 19 cents a gallon, and the oil companies are hurting. I know that I am partly to blame by insisting that cars run on trash. I am therefore proposing a federal bailout to our oil companies because, hey, if it were the other way around, you know the oil companies would help us.
That's Al Gore appearing on Saturday Night Live last year. And we'll be back after a quick break here and now. Every month, violence and instability force some 60,000 Iraqis to flee their homes. It's being called the worst refugee crisis in the Middle East in more than a half century. Here are some facts to put this in perspective. 4.5 million Iraqis, a sixth of the country's pre-war population, have fled their homes, half to other parts of Iraq, half to neighboring countries. But fleeing is getting harder. 11 Iraqi provinces have now closed their borders to the internally displaced. Earlier this year, Jordan closed its borders to Iraqis, and this month Syria began requiring special visas for the refugees. The United States had promised to take in 7,000 Iraqis by the end of September, but because of bureaucratic red tape and delays, it has admitted just a fraction of that, only 1,600. Meanwhile, some 10,000 Iraqis who have fled from the American-led war are waiting to be admitted to the U.S., according to the United Nations. Joining us now from Damascus, Syria, is Sybella Wilkes with the United Nations Refugee Agency. And Sybella, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Sybella, tell us how you see this refugee crisis from where you are in Syria. How many Iraqis are living there, and who are they?
Well, we don't know exactly, but we think that the Syrian government estimate of 1.6 million is a fair estimate. Now, when the Iraqis left, many did not think that they were coming for the long term. They hoped that they were coming and it was going to be less than a year. And what we're seeing is that many are running out of savings. and life is extremely difficult for those people.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that specifically. What is life like for them there? I understand you've been visiting some families. Tell us about their conditions.
Well, let me give you an example. A couple of weeks ago, I went to visit a family that I had seen at the registration center, where we register around 2,000 families each week. And when I went to their home, it was a one-bedroom apartment. They were living in that one-bedroom apartment with another family, so 14 of them in one room. And they had already run out of their savings. They'd been in the country for 3 months, but they were already very poor, having lost their jobs in 2003. The only person in the entire household that was working was the 17-year-old eldest son. He had reached 11th grade when they fled Iraq and would love to continue with his education. But the sad fact is that in order for his family to be able to pay the rent and put only one meal on the table a day, they rely on his income. So, and I think this is, you know, I've met so many families that are in this very sad situation where actually it's their children that find the work, and it's changing the whole social dynamic for families, and it's, you know, potentially going to affect the future of Iraq if many of these children are not able to continue with their education.
Now, Sibella, has Syria been able to absorb these refugees easily? I mean, that's quite a number that you put out there.
Well, it's definitely had a huge impact. I mean, the way that the Syrian economy functions, most foodstuffs, for example, are heavily subsidized. Electricity is subsidized, water is subsidized, all services are subsidized. So 1.6 million people coming into a city that has a population of 3.3 million, this has had a massive, massive impact. We've seen, you know, the Syrian government has always kept the doors open to its schools. But in the areas where there are many Iraqis, this means that in some classrooms, they've now got 3 children per desk. So it's clearly had a massive impact. Prices have also gone up. Rent prices have gone through the roof.
Now, I gather that many of these refugees are waiting to be admitted to the U.S. Can you tell us about that? What's the holdup? What's the situation with them?
The fact is that it's a very, very small number in proportion to the number of refugees we have that will actually be accepted. And this is something, this is a message that we do try and convey to the refugees, that we're here to help them in Syria, because it's clear that although in our resettlement country terms, they think they're offering big numbers, but in terms of the numbers of refugees, I mean, you look throughout the region, it's 4.5 million displaced or refugees, and it's a matter of thousands of resettlement places. We try to submit the most vulnerable cases, the people that urgently, for health reasons or for security reasons, need to leave the region. There are holdups.
And what are the nature of these holdups from your perspective? I mean, I understand, for instance, that Damascus won't give Homeland Security officials visas so they can interview Iraqis in Syria. The U.S. Claims that they need to interview these people face-to-face because they have concerns about who some of these people might be. What's the answer? What has to happen here to sort of loosen up this logjam?
Well, I guess this is going to be a process that we have to discuss, but we hope that we can find some out-of-the-box solutions, because we already go through quite a process to verify who the people are that we submit for resettlement. We understand for all resettlement countries they have their own requirements, but let's hope we can find a solution, because we do have thousands of cases that are ready and prepared for resettlement.
And what happens? I gather that these refugees have to have visas to stay in Syria. What happens if their visas expire before they are resettled?
This is something that we're very, very concerned about. It's 2 weeks now that the Syrian government has imposed a visa regime. And for the majority of refugees in the country, they would still have up-to-date visas, because most would have had a 3-month visa. But we know that by Christmas, the majority, their visas will have expired. And We've had verbal assurances from the Syrian government that no one is going to be forcibly returned to Iraq, but it is making all the refugees feel very insecure. And we receive hundreds of phone calls on our hotline and hundreds of visits every week from refugees, fearful about what will happen as their visas expire.
Well, Sybella Wilkes, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us today.
That's my pleasure.
Sybella Wilkes is with the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Damascus, Syria. Monday on Here and Now, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice back to the Middle East. Can she broker peace there? And still ahead today, October baseball is in the air, especially in Arizona, Colorado, Cleveland, and here in Boston. You're listening to Here and Now. National polls show that health care is the issue voters are most concerned with after the war in Iraq. Today, we're going to take a look at what the presidential candidates are proposing for health care reform. First, to the Democrats. The frontrunners are calling for some form of universal health coverage, and they have a live test laboratory here in Massachusetts. Last year, in this state, lawmakers passed a health care plan that requires all adults to have health insurance and uses employer fees and government funding to offer affordable insurance to low-income residents. So far, 190,000 people have signed up for free or lower-cost coverage in Massachusetts. But could the Massachusetts system work across the country? Here and Now's Martha Biebinger takes a look.
When Senator Hillary Clinton answered questions about her health care plan during a campaign webcast, she could have been describing much of the Massachusetts health care law.
Individuals have to do their part, just like employers, just like the providers who take care of us. The drug and insurance companies have to change the way they do business. And, of course, the government has to participate. So it's shared responsibility, but it really does rest on the individual.
Clinton and one primary opponent, Senator John Edwards, support mandatory health insurance. Senator Barack Obama does not. Like Massachusetts, all three candidates would offer the uninsured subsidized coverage, more affordable insurance options, and would require that most employers insure workers or pay to help cover the uninsured. MIT health economist John Gruber says a health care plan similar to the Massachusetts law is more attractive to voters than a program that lets the federal government run health care.
They realize that the kind of rip it up and start over again approach is not going to work with the American voter, and that this approach that I'm calling sort of universal incrementalism, which is get there in pieces, but get there, is doable.
In Massachusetts, there has been little organized opposition to the new health care law, but there are many cynics. Nicholas Manusis, a 47-year-old uninsured carpenter, stops work on a bar outside Boston to talk about his frustration with the requirement that all adults have health insurance.
It's basically a PR stunt, from my view. They did it politically so they can claim we are going to cover everybody and we'll just pass a law and make them pay for it.
The first penalties for failure to have health insurance kick in next year, at the same time that Clinton, Edwards, or Obama may be going head-to-head with a Republican nominee, defending their health care plans. John Kingsdale runs the Massachusetts effort to cover the uninsured and says Democrats who are adopting the Massachusetts plan while it is in the test phase are taking a gamble.
There is no underestimating the risk of dealing with national health insurance. We got all too many lessons about how it looks like it's within reach and then it slips away and turns around and bites somebody who's trying to lead the way here.
Kingsdale says a health insurance requirement could work nationally as long as there are affordable insurance options. But he offers some warnings.
I think it can translate, but not if it's just sort of rammed down the throat of the country with a very, very slim majority. One of the things that we were able to do here is get this enacted with very, very broad support. I wouldn't want to try to implement this on a 51-49 vote.
The political perils are unfolding. Take California, where Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is pushing to require health insurance. He faces opposition from both fellow Republicans and Democrats who either don't want mandatory coverage or who favor a more sweeping change to government-run health care. In addition to the politics, there's a question of funding. Kingsdale says Massachusetts made its case for universal coverage by shifting money it was already spending on health care to the new program. Clinton, Edwards and Obama would all reverse tax breaks approved during the Bush administration to help fund national coverage for the uninsured. Stuart Altman, who teaches national health policy at Brandeis University, says these candidates understand that most states don't have any extra money for universal coverage.
They recognize that at the national level, the federal government needs to do more because poorer states just can't do what Massachusetts did.
Even though the Massachusetts law is still a work in progress, author, surgeon, and Harvard Medical School professor Atul Gawande says it holds the most promise on what Democrats hope will be a defining domestic issue.
The chapter in Massachusetts has not already been written, but it has shown more hope for the possibility of change, and that's why people have gravitated to the ideas.
And that report from Here and Now's Martha Biebinger. None of the Republican candidates, including former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, who championed mandatory health insurance in Massachusetts, supports universal coverage. So what are Republicans offering? For more on that, we go to Dr. Bob Blendon, who directs the Harvard Program on Public Opinion and Health and Social Policy. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here today.
What's the main difference between what Republicans and Democrats are proposing on the presidential trail here?
The Democrats are focusing on the principle that the federal government should guarantee health insurance for all Americans with lots of choices. The Republicans are arguing that we don't need a new federal plan. What we need are incentives through the tax system for individuals to be able to make choices themselves.
Senator John McCain was the latest candidate, Republican candidate, to unveil his health care plan. What's he proposing?
He has the strongest set of proposals to sort of lower the cost of care for middle-income people by giving them access to choices of clinics like Walmart, letting physicians go between different states, making it easier to buy plans in different states. But what is common between all three candidates is their use of either tax deductions or tax credits to provide incentives for people to purchase insurance, but without a requirement that they do it or a guarantee that the amount of subsidies will be enough that everyone at the end of the day will have coverage.
And by all three candidates, you're talking about Romney, McCain, and Giuliani.
So one relies more on a credit, one relies more on a tax deduction, one relies more on incentives to states to offer more choices.
Doesn't this put the former governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, in a peculiar position in that he was the governor who has taken credit for and pushed for and signed into law a bill that would do pretty much what the Democrats are now proposing they want to do?
Yes. But what Governor Romney has said is that what he supported in Massachusetts was the right of each state to take a direction of how it would solve this problem, not that there was a Massachusetts-type solution for every state.
And based on polling data that you've seen, what do voters want?
Democratic voters are very interested in a plan where the federal government would guarantee coverage for everybody. Republican voters are interested in improvements and a focus on cost of care issues. Independent voters are divided. Some would like a large plan, and that'll be important in the general election. Others want something more modest done about health care and are likely to worry about a new big government plan. What we see is that a share of voters have said that they want health care to be a more important issue in this campaign, but it doesn't mean the same thing to all voters.
Well, Bob Blendon, thanks so much for joining us today and talking about this.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Dr. Bob Blendon, who directs the Harvard Program on Public Opinion and Health and Social Policy. And you're listening to Here and Now. It's October, which means it's time to obsess about the playoffs and our national pastimes. So here we go. The Colorado Rockies continue their winning ways, beating the Arizona Diamondbacks 5-1 last night in the first game of the National League Championship Series. They've now won 18 of their last 19 games. Talk about sizzling hot. Here to talk about that story and more is our own Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. And good to see you again, Bill.
It's good to be back.
No one expected these Rockies to make it to the playoffs, yet here here they are. They've won 18 of 19 with a team of mostly young, mostly unknowns, no big stars, one of the smallest payrolls in baseball. Is this luck? What's going on here?
It's a great story. And to give people an idea of how unusual this is, the last National League team to win 18 of 19 games was the 86 Mets, and they did it very close to the beginning of the season. So all they did was establish a big lead and dare everybody else to catch them. To do this in these circumstances, where Colorado had pretty well been written off about a month ago, they decided we pretty much have to run the table. We have to win all the rest of our games to make the playoffs. And then they all but did it. They've lost one game in the last 19.
Talk about peaking at the right time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Terrific pitching from Jeff Francis last night, who apparently, though he's still very young, simply doesn't worry about being at the altitude that he's at. Maybe the Rockies are used to playing at a high altitude, so the championship series doesn't bother them. Kaz Matsui, who basically didn't impress people very much when he played for the Mets, has found that he plays much better in Colorado than he did in New York. Todd Helton, of course, an established star. Aside from there, I don't know where you find household names in this lineup.
Fascinating. Meanwhile, the Cleveland Indians at Fenway Park to take on the Red Sox for the American League Championship Series. Game one is tonight. For once, the Red Sox don't appear to be the underdogs.
They're the favorite.
Amazing.
Absolutely, the betting line favorite. And if things go according to form, which in baseball they so rarely do, which is why it's such a fun game to watch, the Indians should lose this series to the Red Sox. The Red Sox, on paper, they're the stronger team. But Sabathia, Carmona, these are pitchers who are capable on any given night of shutting down any team, and it's a short series even when it's best 4 of 7, so Cleveland has a real shot, and it'll be fascinating, I think, if both teams play as well as they can play. This should be a magnificent series.
Well, we can't talk about Boston and Cleveland without talking about the Reds, without talking about the New York Yankees, who were beaten fairly decisively by Cleveland in the first round of the playoffs. Alex Rodriguez could become a free agent, and his future with the team is up in the air. Joe Torre might be gone after the owner, George Steinbrenner, said he would be gone if they didn't win. To make matters worse, there was the Yankee radio analyst Susan Waldman's teary post-game report from the clubhouse describing what poor Joe Torre and his staff were going through after the loss. Let's listen to this.
This has been the best 12 years of my life. I wouldn't have missed this for anybody. Now, I was okay, actually, until I went into the clubhouse, and the coaches are sitting in Torre's office, and they are watching this. And the tears that you hear in my voice are coming down the faces of the coaches in that coach's room.
Yeah, obviously she didn't see the movie A League of Their Own. So Bill, can we cue the Jimmy Duggan's Tom Hanks tape from that movie?
There's no crying in baseball!
Sorry, Tom.
There's no crying
in baseball, at least in New York baseball. What team besides the New York Yankees could get eliminated from the playoffs and the following day be the biggest story in Major League Baseball?
It is amazing.
It is absolutely amazing, and they're absolutely pushing this story forward by saying now that they won't make a decision on Joe Torre for at least several more days. So for at least several more days, they will continue to be the biggest story in Major League Baseball as everybody on every other team weighs in on the future of Joe Torre.
Well, let's talk about the future of the Yankees. I mean, are they going to look, in your view, much different next spring? I mean, Torre might be gone. Rodriguez might be gone. Posada, Jorge Posada, their catcher, even their stellar reliever, Mariano Rivera, his contract is up. What's going to happen?
Well, they got some old guys, too. Messina's kind of toward the end of his career. I think it's absolutely a fair bet that they will look very different.
Bill Littlefield covers sports for us each week and is the author of the new book, Only a Game, which just happens to be the title of the radio show he hosts on NPR. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Tony.
Still to come, some call him our best contemporary composer. We'll visit with Osvaldo Golahoy here and now. Osvaldo Golahoy is one of the hottest composers in classical music, and according to some, the best and the busiest. His Grammy-winning opera, Ina Damar, plays in Boston next weekend. Yo-Yo Ma and the Boston Symphony perform his cello concerto, Azul, in December. Then comes an opera at the Met in New York, two film scores for Francis Ford Coppola, a new piece for the Chicago Symphony, recordings for Deutsche Grammophon, and, well, you get the idea. Gollihoff is a productive fellow, and somehow he found time to sit down with Here and Now critic at large Ed Siegel.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too. I still don't know how to open it from the inside.
Osvaldo Gollihoff didn't know it until the day he moved in, but his newly renovated apartment just outside Boston was once a church called St. Mark's. It's appropriate because the work that put Gollihoff on the classical music map was a dramatic South American reconversion of the St. Mark Passion. It's also fitting because the cathedral ceiling digs that double as his studio echo the meeting of the spiritual and the earthy that's made Gollihoff's music among the most sought after in the world.
I have serious doubts about my own music, but I realize that at least the attempt is there to embrace the entire range of human experience. In that sense, it's really more connected, I feel, to the great composers that I love from the past than generations that came right before me, which were content with just exploring certain areas of thought.
Gollihoff's diverse musical palette comes naturally. Born in 1960 to Eastern European parents, he grew up in Argentina, moved to Israel, and then America. Classical, tango, klezmer, sampling, gypsy music, they're all in his multicultural musical bones. In Gollihoff's Night of the Flying Horses, played here by Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble, a Yiddish lullaby adds gypsy and Asian colorings before exploding into a fast-paced gallop. One influence you hear most clearly in Gollihoff's music is Argentinian tango master Astor Piazzolla, whose musical portraits of Buenos Aires Gollihoff likens to Dickens' prose about London. The movement of Last Round that Gollihoff talks about here was written when he heard of Piazzolla's fatal stroke in 1992.
The idea was to have two string orchestras facing each other, breathing in and out, as a bandoneon, the tango instrument that Piazzolla played, that is similar to an accordion, with strings. I would say that the melody that I use, that is a variation of an old tango called My Beloved Buenos Aires, is not as important as that sense of breathing in and out. So, that's nothing. But when you hear it in the orchestra,
if Last Round is a case of tango meeting klezmer meeting Mahler, Gollihoff's The St. Mark Passion is a seamless pairing of Jewish and Christian liturgical music with European and Latin American motifs.
In the opening of the Passion, we have the birimbau, the amazing Brazilian instrument that is almost hypnotic, going... piano is nothing, but when you hear it, tong, 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 you can see a ritual is about to unfold.
Eine Damar, Gollihoff's opera that tours this fall, reunites its original director, Peter Sellers, with Gollihoff's muse, Don Upshaw.
Upshaw and Golihov have won countless awards for their collaborations. Ina de Mar deals with the murder of Spanish poet and playwright Federico García Lorca by Spanish fascists. Now, no one's going to confuse Golihov with DJ Shadow, but there's a fair amount of sampling in this work, from galloping horses to the sound of bullets killing García Lorca. There's also a strong political theme, as the officer who orders García Lorca's execution utters words more closely associated with a contemporary leader. Whoever is not with us is against us. And of course, there's Upshaw. Here's her entrance in Ina de Mar as Margarita Xirgu, an actress lamenting García Lorca's death and trying to pass on the twin message of artistic and political freedom he championed to a new generation.
For me to discover that there is a singer in this world that has the emotional truth that the popular voices have, but also to, for whom you can write anything that occurs to you, and she's willing to go for it blind, then that's beyond a blessing. I mean, she's something like a miracle, you know.
Upshaw's become a champion of new music, and if her voice can at times be a little too sweet, its breadth and beauty are perfect for Golihov. You've probably never heard Upshaw sound anything like she does singing these 15th century medieval Spanish songs, Aire, where Arabian influences join in. What Golihov is doing with popular and classical music is not terribly different from Copland and Gershwin incorporating jazz into their compositions. It's just that nobody today is doing it better.
There is only one life, and I have the fortune of doing what I love, and what I love includes all these incredible musics that come from entire people's experiences. So I love this music, and I will use it because love is strong.
Osvaldo Golihov talking with Here and Now critic-at-large Ed Siegel. Golihov's Ina de Mar, featuring Dawn Upshaw, begins a nationwide tour October 19th in Boston. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Robin Young returns on Monday. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.